The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 4, our series on health professions education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, but joined by two wonderful co-hosts today, Dr. Yura Krzyzanowskaia and our returning producer, Dr. Charlotte Chaiklin. On today's episode, we'll discuss how to be an effective change agent with Dr. Stephanie Brown. Before we get started with that, Yura, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
You got it, Molly. We are the podcast for all things health professions education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. Charlotte, do you want to introduce our guest tonight?
Oh, definitely. We had a fantastic conversation tonight with my beloved residency program director, the one and only Dr. Stephanie Brown, discussing how to be an effective change agent. Dr. Brown is an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics, the division chief of the University of Miami Medicine and Pediatrics Division, and the internal medicine residency program director at the University of Miami Jackson Memorial Hospital Residency Program. She has received the Hall of Heroes Award from the Student National Medical Association, Excellence and Mentorship Award from the University of Miami Women in Academic Medicine, South Florida Top Black Educator Award from the ICABA, and the Most Accomplished Black Executives Award from the ICABA. Her teaching interests include evidence-based medicine, leadership, and the business of medicine.
And we're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine, or AIM. And this episode is part of our leadership mini-series that's been created with AIM. This is a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the family content of Curbsiders and you haven't joined the Patreon yet, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource.
We had a great conversation with Dr. Stephanie Brown tonight. We covered topics around how to be a great leader, especially through the lens of change management. We talked through her experiences on how to convert from a traditional residency schedule into a block or X plus Y schedule, and then also her experiences in developing fellowship and career pathways. And so I think if you're looking for tips about those specifically, you'll gain a lot of great insights, but also she shares just so much wisdom around being an excellent leader in general.
So without further ado, let's get to it.
Dr. Brown, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. Are you okay if we call you Stephanie for this recording?
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. Please do.
Thank you. Well, we'd like to just ask some general questions so our audience can get to know you a little bit better. Could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself? And if you can include something from outside of medicine, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. I am a Star Wars loving, detective show watching, program director. I love designing new things. I find that what I do outside of work actually is I do pottery class every Saturday. And that's been a really great creative outlet. What I didn't realize is that I also take opportunities, almost every opportunity I can, to be creative in my job and to be creative with the program and thinking about how to get from A to B or about a million different pathways to get there. And I try to take as many as I can.
That's awesome. That was great. And I guess I wonder, just to piggyback off of the Star Wars slash detective shows slash maybe pottery in those things, what's a recent movie or show or even book that you enjoyed and want to share with our audience?
You know, during the pandemic, I kind of got into streaming lots and lots of things. And I blame one of my former co-residents for getting me into that habit. And there's a show on Hulu called Will Trent. It's about a detective who's dyslexic and who's had kind of a hard life in foster care, et cetera. And I recently discovered that those are also books. And so I started reading all of that series.
Awesome. So we're here to talk about leadership tonight. And I was wondering if you could share with us some meaningful leadership advice or feedback that you have received during your career or maybe even training.
I think some of the best leadership advice that I've gotten is to really be an active listener to the people who you lead. And that leadership is not about standing in the front, but it's about holding hands with the people that are alongside of you and walking together. So leadership is really more about the vision and taking people along with you on that vision. And, you know, management is about the nuts and bolts, and you have to do a little bit of both, especially in change management.
Well, I love that image of holding hands together side by side as a leader. I think that's beautiful and also great to wrap it back into our topic for today. But before we jump into change management, Ira, I know you have a pick of the week you'd love to share, and we could start with you, and then Charlotte, if you have one too.
Can do, Molly. You read me too well. Stephanie, I wonder if you've seen this, just because it doesn't have quite the detective show vibe, but kind of the spy thriller vibe. It's a show that I've gotten into recently called Slow Horses on Apple TV, previously brought the same streaming platform that brought you Ted Lasso that I'm also obsessed with. But Slow Horses basically follows a group of agents who were quote-unquote rejects from MI5 in Britain, and they're now kind of consigned to doing basically jobs that no one wants to do because they were kind of the agents that were sacked. And it's really funny because it's like British humor. You have to be a little bit okay with, you know, some murder, some kind of like cussing and other, you know, less like potty mouth humor. But it's very, very funny in that British kind of dryness. And the plot is just really, really well done. And it's based off of a book, the kind of Slough House series of novels by Mick Herron. But the show I'd highly recommend. And the fourth season is coming out, I think, later this year. Really pumped about it. So check it out if you have Apple TV or borrow a friend's login.
I do not have Apple TV. Friends have been trying to convince me to sign up for yet another streaming service because I've signed up to almost all of them. But I like British detective shows and British humor, and so I'll definitely check it out.
Charlotte, do you have a pick of the week?
I do. My spouse always laughs at me when I say the title, but it's a book called Out of Shape, Worthless Loser, and it's written by Gracie Cole. It's a memoir, who is an Olympian figure skater, and it kind of opened the doors to Olympic figure skating, which is a world I knew nothing about before reading this book. It was recommended to me by my Lateral County Library, my local library librarian. It was really fantastic. Kind of takes me out of medicine and into a different world. Which is nice and refreshing after a long day of work.
Very cool. And is the title because she's like post Olympian shape, or she's just hard on herself
that?
Because figure skaters are hard on themselves?
She's hard on herself. That's her like mean voice that she's titled Out of Shape, Worthless Loser. And yeah, it kind of tackles eating disorder and the rigor of being an Olympic athlete, which is quite tough, especially because it seems as though her childhood gets kind of robbed from her becoming an Olympian.
That sounds like a good read.
Luckily, me and my family are not very athletic, so not something I have to worry about with my kids. yeah, I just finished a show on Netflix, The Queen's Gambit. I don't know if
yes.
Anyone has seen it.
Yes, oh my God, of course.
I loved it. I think I'm late to the game. I think it's most people have seen it by now, but just the character was so fun. It's a fictional story from the 60s about this woman who's kind of breaking into the world of men's chess and her rise to becoming one of the top chess players in the world at that time, and her struggle with substance use disorder, and just kind of her making sense of the world as someone who is obsessed with chess and like kind of balancing that with trying to be a regular person. So I thought it was great.
I was obsessed with that show. Literally binged it. It was so, so good in a weekend.
Well, great. Let's jump into our topic for today. Charlotte, do you want to start us off with a case from Cashlock?
Sure. So this is a case about Jackson. He's a new program director who is taking on the task of transforming his internal medicine residency program's current modified traditional schedule into an X plus Y or block schedule. And he comes to you, Stephanie, as someone who has successfully led an internal medicine residency program through this type of change, and asks for advice on how to lead his program and his residents through this change. Before we kind of get more into the case specifically, can you kind of tell us where your leadership journey started?
Yeah, sure. It really started when I was a PGY3 resident. So I'm a med peds resident, which is a 4-year residency. So it was kind of in the middle. My goal in life was always to be in a private practice and see adults and children. And I hadn't really thought about leadership position. And one of my attendings said, "Hey, did you ever think about applying for a primary care chief position? I think it would be great." I loved the teaching. I loved working with residents, loved working with students, loved the environment, loved education. Both my parents were educators. My mom was a teacher who became a director of curriculum, and my father was a principal. So I spent a lot of my life in schools. Like, some of my earliest memories were sitting on my mom's desk while she was setting up her classroom. And I started thinking about it, realized how much I loved it, and sort of fell into it. And I think I've said this to Charlotte before, as I was her program director. Some of my career has been a long, slow fall down the stairs. I just sort of landed in places. You know, you just slid down and you land in places and you stay there for a while. And, you know, some of the advice I give now to residents is to be a little bit more strategic about what you want and what you think about. And I really loved leadership and fell into it by applying for chief residency. And that was where I started my leadership journey.
Stephanie, that's an amazing, first of all, image. I'm like imagining all of us like just tumbling in an avalanche down the stairs together. But in thinking about that journey, and before we kind of advise Jackson on your kind of approach to leadership, was there, outside of that chief resident experience, was there something that really made it or that was really formative for you in becoming the successful leader that you are today? And maybe it was that chief year, but maybe it was something else.
No, I think part of it was seeing both my parents who were in leadership positions and not really thinking about it or reflecting on it too much, but seeing what they did and how they moved in those positions, how they spoke to people, how they spoke to everyone from the person who was, you know, sweeping the floors to the person who was the kid who was in the classroom. They did a lot of mentoring of children, both like, and even kids in the neighborhood, kids showing up at the house for extra tutoring sessions. So we always had people in and out of the house who they were mentoring. And my mom, even now, she's retired now, I think almost 20 years, and she's still mentoring in high schools and colleges, and she has a scholarship funds. And so I think just seeing how my parents moved through the world as leaders really set me up for being a little bit of a servant leader, because that's always what they did.
Amazing. Those role models are so important. And sounds like you are now the role model for us, which I really appreciate, and have been for Charlotte in the past as well. So
absolutely.
We're excited to pick your brain some more. When we think specifically about this case, about Jackson, and you think about the task ahead of him, just to give our listeners some background in case they're not so much in the DME space, what is the difference between a modified traditional internal medicine schedule versus an X plus Y schedule?
So if we think about traditional schedules, which is where I trained in a traditional schedule, so number one, when I was in residency, there were no duty hours rules except for in New York City. So in a traditional schedule, the majority of your time is spent in inpatient rotation with maybe one or two electives a year. And on your inpatient rotations, you go to the continuity clinic every week, the same session. You know, for me, that was Wednesday afternoons. I was in continuity clinic, whether I was pre-call, post-call, on-call. Only in the ICU did you not go to your continuity clinic. So there was always this push and pull of you're in your continuity clinic seeing patients, but you're, at that time, pager is going off. Your pager's going off. Interns are calling you with questions. The chief residents were responsible for making the schedule such that when you were on the team, none of the team members had the same clinic schedule. So you were never a part of a team necessarily in the outpatient setting. You were part of a team in the inpatient setting. And in the outpatient setting, you just kind of went there for half a day a week. And many people saw it as an interruption in their inpatient care. And it was really tough for me, who wanted to go into primary care, not being able to ever really focus on it. I was there for half a day. I had to be there on time at 1:00. And then I had to go back and do call, or I had to go back and finish my admissions or go back and finish with patients. go back and make sure the interns were okay, make sure the orders were done, make sure the notes were done. So there was really always this push and pull that you felt as a resident in a traditional schedule. And a block scheduling really started at the first program that started it was in 2008. That first paper about block scheduling was in 2010. They, instead of calling it an X plus Y schedule, the first paper called it a 4-to-1 schedule, sort of a ratio. You know, that people were doing 4 weeks of inpatient and then 1 week of clinic. So they were only really out of the inpatient realm, still really focused, still really residency at that time was focused on inpatient training. But the block scheduling was the first time people were really able to focus on their primary care, not be interrupted in primary care by pagers or doing inpatient tasks or speaking to nurses outside of the clinic, allowed for ambulatory education that wasn't rushed. There were many, many different models in the traditional schedule for ambulatory education, 15 minutes before clinic, staying after clinic. Someone would bring an article and talk about it, or someone would talk about, hey, let's talk about the oral treatments for diabetes, or hey, let's talk about antihypertensive. Let's talk about, at that time, JNC8. So, you know, ambulatory education was always rushed, took really a backseat to your inpatient education. Noon conference was very much focused on inpatient topics, which is where you got most of your education. And ambulatory was really a leftover. So maybe 2005, 2006, the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine, I believe the ABIM and the ACGME, they got together and came up with a consensus statement on the fact that residency training needed to be redesigned. And that's when people really started to look at different ways to do things. And the block scheduling was one of the first. And so, like I said, the first program, I think, was Lehigh. Yeah, it was Lehigh Valley, and they did a 4-to-1 schedule. They looked at it sort of an odds or ratio of 4 weeks of inpatient to 1 week of outpatient. And then the second people to write about it were the first people to use that term X plus Y. So there was 4+1, and now there are multiple different iterations of that. And our program is actually a 4+2+2. Yeah, and X plus Y plus D. So yeah, so the X is still the 4 week block. And then the Y and the Z are your clinic blocks. So some people are in a Y schedule, some people are in a Z schedule. But we have four firms, and each firm is in clinic for 2 weeks at a time. And they're in clinic for 2 weeks, and those half of the days are clinic, the other half are either elective or acute care. They could be research, or they could be they're other ambulatory electives. So that time is spent in ambulatory, whether you're in your clinic for half days or you're in your ambulatory elective for half days.
And Stephanie, for those of us who are super concrete, including myself, could you just spell out, like, what's the advantage to the X plus Y plus Z, 4+2+2, like, as opposed to, you know, spending every week for a half day in clinic? I mean, I think some of us can imagine, but just to spell it out for those concrete listeners.
Sure. Yeah. So that the advantage to a block schedule is that you are in clinic for 2 weeks at a time. It allows for really focusing on your ambulatory practice, really focusing on your patients in the outpatient setting. It allows for better modeling of what a real world ambulatory experience is. And I'm not just talking about ambulatory internal medicine. It could be cardiology, GI, surgery. You know, no matter what you do in life, you will spend time in the ambulatory setting, no matter what specialty you do. That could be also pharmacy. We now have pharmacists embedded in our primary care practice who do medication counseling for patients. So we can refer a patient to the pharmacist, the outpatient pharmacist who's in the clinic with us 3 half-days a week, seeing patients and talking to them about their medications and the side effects and how you take them, and doing education on how do I inject, how do I do a sub-Q medication, what's proper technique.
I love that, because I feel like you're bringing in the interprofessional perspective on this, that, like, it decreases fragmented care for all the clinicians involved and all the people in patient care. There's better learning. There's better, again, it sounds like probably satisfaction for the people providing the clinical care, but and hopefully we think maybe for the patients too, as well.
Yeah, they've actually, I mean, most of the studies have focused on resident satisfaction, but more recently there was a meta-analysis 2019 that looked at what is block scheduling done for things. So it has definitely increased resident satisfaction, not only satisfaction with their continuity clinic, but satisfaction with the balance between inpatient and ambulatory, being able to have a break between inpatient and ambulatory, decrease that fragmented care where you had to run over from the wards to be in clinic for 4 hours and then run back to finish all of your work, has really allowed people to sort of have a primary care life. Has allowed for faculty to provide ambulatory education. We have an ambulatory academic half day, for example, that's separate from our inpatient academic half day that teaches completely different topics and is able to be done in smaller groups, because for most block scheduling, residents are divided into firms and they travel together between their four-week rotations and their ambulatory rotations. So their X and their Y, they travel together. One of the side benefits that I don't think has been really studied, but the staff also benefits in that they're seeing, instead of seeing residents just a half a day a week, they're seeing them for a week or 2 week blocks or in some of the different variations. 4+1, 4+2 are the most common, but there are also 4+4 and 3+3. It allows for a little bit of a different way to look at residency practice, not as just a pop in and pop out, but really having a panel, really owning your clinic, really getting to know the staff. You're there for a week at a time every day. And it really does allow for satisfaction, I think, on all fronts. When they've looked at patient satisfaction, it hasn't really changed patient satisfaction that much. But I think when the meta-analysis, there were only about 3 studies that looked at patient satisfaction. There were 8,000 studies that they found. But after they whittled everything down and looked at quality, there were really only 11 studies, and there was too much heterogeneity to really combine them and do a meta-analysis. So it was a systematic review and descriptive.
It seems that there's just so many benefits of doing block scheduling. But kind of going back to our case with Jackson, change is really scary, I think, for most people. I know you've done this successfully, so that's why we're picking your brain tonight, kind of. As a leader trying to make a change, like going from a traditional schedule to a X plus Y or block schedule for a residency program, are there any types of leadership frameworks or approaches that you found were most helpful or that are most helpful?
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time, but John Cotter's work on the 8 steps for leading transformational change, those steps are really helpful. I think I had a lot of those things, even though I didn't really know it. I think the first question Jackson needs to answer is, why am I doing this? What's the reason? What are the goals for the residency? What are the factors? Are there internal factors? What are the external factors? You know, for example, do you have citations that you need to answer? Or do you think your service is valued over education? Is there duplication? So the first question you need to answer is why. So block scheduling at internal medicine sort of started as a response to several different needs for stakeholders like the ABIM and the ACGME, just sort of a reframe of what are we doing in internal medicine residencies? What are the goals here? And it's been adopted by many other primary care specialties like pediatrics and med peds programs and family medicine have adopted it. So the first question you need to ask is why? So what are the goals for the program? What are the goals for the residents? And then thinking a little bit broader than just the program and the residents, what is the system mission? What's the mission of the system or of your institutions? So you need to think not only individually, but also system-wide. And creating a win-win for the system and for the program is the best outcome that you can hope for.
When this was something that you took on, was it something that you had read about and learned about and were excited, or something that the residents and the rest of the team were asking for?
Yeah, it was something that had been talked about for a few years. the residents for sure were interested. They were on traditional schedule, and which meant we have a 4-week block system. So in a 13 block system, one block, you know, a four week block is vacation. You know, usually split up into two week blocks, which left 12 other blocks, the majority of which were inpatient blocks, and that was a little bit exhausting. And there was many places, many of the rotations were Q4, such as the ICU rotations or even Q3 at the, you know, at their most stringent. So it's a little bit exhausting. It doesn't really allow for time for curriculum development. And for me, that was curriculum development and also career development were, I think, the most important things for me. And maybe because when I did residency, there wasn't really a focus on resident development. Your career development was sort of after you were done with residency, and residency was a necessary evil to get to that career piece. And I felt like right after residency, I was really trying to figure out career. You know, I knew that I liked education. I didn't really have mentorship. So being a MedPeds resident in the early 2000s, MedPeds programs were accredited by the ABIM, the American Board of Internal Medicine, and the American Board of Pediatrics, and not by the ACGME. So the MedPeds programs were first accredited in 2007. So one of the big things for me was, as a resident, very often the MedPeds residents were sort of relegated to whatever was left over in the schedule after everyone else was done, after medicine was done and peds was done. So after that seed was planted in my head about becoming a chief resident, I started thinking about what I would do. And one of the first things I did was, hey, why don't I do the MedPeds schedule first? This way it's all done and you guys can schedule around us where there's only 16 of us. It'll be great. And that was kind of one of my first leadership residents. And that was before I was a chief resident. That was in my fourth year of residency. I was like, I need to fix this for all of us as a group.
I love that, Stephanie, because I feel like you're like doing step 5 of the Cotter's, you know, steps. And just for kind of listeners, because I had to remind myself about this every single time, the Cotter's 8 kind of step model is like step 1, create a sense of urgency. Step 2, form a powerful coalition. Step 3 is the vision, creating that. Step 4 is communicating that vision. Step 5 is removing the obstacles. Like, let me make that MedPeds schedule for you. Get it done. Step 6, like create short-term wins. Step 7, build on the change. And then 8, anchor the change in kind of the culture of the institution. And I wonder, Stephanie, if you're kind of thinking about Jackson's case here and, you know, thinking about the residents and the stakeholders, how did you form, I know we're kind of jumping to step 2 because it sounds like we have a sense of urgency. We know that this needs to happen. It's kind of a crap situation at the moment. So how did you form that powerful coalition and get buy-in from like the necessary stakeholders?
To be honest, some of the work was done before I became the program director. So I was the MedPeds program director and I was asked to move into the medicine program director role when a new chair came along. He wanted to make change, heard about things that I had done with the MedPeds program at the time, and asked me to move into the medicine program director role. So I'd been kind of looking from afar-ish, you know, for a few years, because for 7 years, I was the MedPeds program director, which necessitated working with the medicine program director and with the PEDS program director. And so I'd been looking from afar and thinking about what I would do. And then I was asked to do it. So I already had ideas in my head. And when I started talking to the associate program directors that I inherited in internal medicine, they said, this is what we've been wanting to do for years. And there had been a group of chief residents that had worked on a plan that really didn't sort of gain traction and support. And I said, well, let's do it. And I went to the chair and I said, I want to go to block scheduling. And he's like, that sounds like a great idea. You should do it next academic year. This was March, and academic year started in July. So it's a really nice paper in 2014. And that's a mix of people. I think it's Penn, ChristianaCare. So it's a mix of university and Boston University, a mix of university programs and community programs, medium-sized to large residencies and small residencies. It's a mix of programs that wrote a paper on, like, what questions do you need to ask yourselves? What do you think you need to think about. And I read that paper. I went to my chair. I said, I want to do this. They said it takes a year. He said, okay, well, you can do it in 3 months, right? And I said, well, I guess so. And I said, well, yeah, like maybe 9 months. He's like, no, 3 months. I'm like, 9 months. And we sort of went back and forth and settled on 3 months. And that's what we did. But I had already people that had done some preliminary work. And I think it was that recent systematic review that said that while the recommendation is a year, people can do it faster because of sense of urgency. The beginning of an academic year is always a great time to do these kinds of things. And I did have to give time to some people for some people to adjust. But I had the support of the chair, who was a new chair, and that went a long way, I think, in helping me to convince other people. The residents were easy to convince and said, hey, you're going to go from 11 blocks of inpatient to like 6 or 7 blocks of inpatient with a lot more time for electives, a lot more time for your own career development. But whenever you go from a traditional schedule to a block schedule, something has to go, right? Even if you just have 15 residents and you're on a 1 month schedule, which some places still are doing 12 months, and so that you have 12 rotations, one of which ends up being a vacation, and you move from someone that's doing 11 months of inpatient to now doing 9 months or 8 months or 10 months, something has to go. And that, I think, is one of the biggest obstacles in reductions in resident service. So the first thing I think you need to do is look at, you know, what's your dream? What's your educational dream? If you could design everything from the beginning, what is it? And then number two, okay, what do we have? And where do I have duplications? And where do I need additions? As an example, when we started, we have 3 institutions, a VA, a county hospital, and a private hospital. All 3 of them had a CCU. All 3 of those CCUs were staffed. Not everybody wants to do cardiology as much as my cardiology friends love to think that that's true. You know, only about 10% of the or 10 residents out of our 40 residents, so maybe 20% of our folks wanted to do cardiology, but everyone was doing so much cardiology. So I looked at the 3 units and I said, the analogy I'd like to use is EDU versus RVU. So what's the education versus the service? And so there are many places where you're going to get more education than you're doing service. There's places where it's equal, and there's places where you're not as getting as much education as you are doing service. And so what do each of those 3 units look like? How many beds are there? How many people am I staffing at Q4 because that's what everyone's expecting? You know, but it's a 10-bed unit. Do we really need to be there Q4 as a second year or a third year? So really looking at what's your educational value of your rotations, where's your duplication? So for us, that was in cardiology and in hemonc to a certain extent, because we have an NCI-designated cancer center that has their own inpatient unit that used to be staffed by residents and fellows. And oddly enough, as we started to change the residency program, the fellowship started to follow suit and saying, do we really need to staff that? Is that really important for fellows? Is this a place that faculty can work with hospitalists, you know, in a multidisciplinary model? So as the residency started to change, really the whole institution started to change and started to look at things that way. But it was not easy for the places that lost, so to speak, resident service.
Well, it sounds like you were in a lucky position that you had the buy-in from your leadership and your residents, and that, you know, it was a place that was ready for change. But sounds like you had some very challenging situations to work through with making those other departments accept the reduction in staffing. But it sounds like you were able to lead them through successfully. Do you have any other strategies that help you manage getting through this change, or any other kind of tips that help you get past those obstacles for people that might be trying to do this or other changes?
Yeah, I think for some of it was just time. For some of those things, it was just time. People were very used to residents staffing every single area, and moving to different models opened up other avenues. So, for example, the anesthesia residency needs cardiology rotation. I said, hey, we're going to vacate this cardiology rotation. Would you be interested? Is that something that would help you? Our sort of really rethinking what we really needed and what we really wanted helped other programs, opened up opportunities for other programs.
I want to highlight, I think that's a step six, create short-term wins, because I think that by acknowledging that to the anesthesia programs, you're saying like, hey, it's a win for you, it's a win for us. Like we don't, there's not really a net loss of staffing.
Right, exactly. And enabled faculty to really work with folks from other disciplines. So it enabled some, you know, unintended interdisciplinary work in emergency medicine residents in critical care areas, anesthesiologists, family medicine folks rotate with us through the ICU. And honestly, the reason for the 4+2+2 was to really allow for other programs who were not on block schedule to still have 4 weeks of rotation. So it was a little bit of a compromise that actually really worked out for all of the other services that rotate with us. And then our pharmacy residents also rotate with us for 4 weeks at a time because they have to do onc pharmacy, they do IT, you know, they do internal medicine, they do a little bit of peds. So there are other residency programs. Even and now, you know, we're almost 10 years later now, you know, some of the other interdisciplinary programs in the institution have started their own training programs. Like we have a 1 year like a nurse practitioner training program in our cancer hospital. So in places where residents were staffing, there are now nurse practitioners who are just straight out of their own training program that are being supervised and trained by seasoned nurse practitioners who rotate as their attendings, and they're in a residency of their own sorts.
So amazing. We're going to go back to Jackson for a moment.
Sure.
And in kind of the spirit of change, and I know you've done this successfully as well, so I'm excited to have you share your wisdom with us. But Jackson gets through the conversion from a modified traditional to a X plus Y or block schedule in his residency program. And now he wants to focus on creating fellowship and career pathways for the training program for his residents. So our first question for you really is, how as a leader do you decide where to focus your energy for change when there's so oftentimes many different competing concerns and maybe visions that you have as a leader for a program?
Sure. So for us, one of our pathways, Global Health, had been around for a while in various forms. So that was a sort of natural step to say, hey, let's make this more formal. Let's blend it into now our block schedule and figure out how we're going to have people do Global Health. And then our second pathway was actually Urban Health, where we had someone who had done the Urban Health residency at Johns Hopkins who joined us as faculty and said, hey, I'd be interested in starting this here. And that was very much values aligned with the institution, who is looking to try to create more primary care physicians. We're in an urban environment, and we designed the residency to really prepare people to sort of practice where we are, to practice in a place where patients are under-resourced or unresourced completely in an urban environment. It's a county hospital. So the institution was excited about that because they thought, hey, this is actually creating people that might stay here and work here and be with us, be trained here and be passionate about something like this. And we can keep them. And that's how we started the urban health track. And then the next four pathway, then the next decisions were really resident-centric and based on the four most popular specialties in application for fellowship, which was cardiology, GI, pulmonary critical care, and hem-onc for us. And so we worked with faculty, not necessarily the program director, but in some cases the program director, to create these pathways. We leveraged that block schedule and said, okay, we said, hey, we're going to start these pathways likely in second year. What do people need to do to be ready for fellowship? So all of our pathways are built around experiences. So the first ones were clinical experiences and then mentorship experiences and scholarship experiences. And so it was important that each of the pathways had a leader who was in that specialty, who could really show people in that specialty the breadth of that specialty and to make sure that people had options for mentors. So the second year of each pathway is based around sort of the core experiences for that specialty. And then the third year is really based on sort of taking your passion, your interest deeper. So within the GI and hepatology pathway, for example, you can then choose, am I going to do mostly GI electives? I'm going to do mostly hepatology electives. Who are my mentors going to be? And it really allows people to develop a career focus and to be ready when they start fellowship. They're already, you know, several steps ahead of the game in knowing about the breadth of the specialty and knowing what kind of lifestyle you might have, what kind of things can you do, and really being exposed in a deep way to all of the things for that particular pathway, but also making sure that everybody gets their general internal medicine. So the way I like to think about it and the way I explain it is it's like the pathways are like college majors. You can single major, you can double major. We've had some people start to request a triple major. I think that's a lot. It's pretty tight to get everything done. But people have very successfully double majored. And right now we have 10 fellowship pathways. The 10th one was just created. So a lot more than when you were here, Charlotte.
I also love that it's like academic medicine where we're like, we're not going to single major. We're going to double and triple major. Like, can we do the most at one time? And Stephanie, I also love like how you kind of transitioned from, you know, your residency experience where you're like, whoa, wait a second. I got like no continuity or like significant, like, a, you know, it sounds like a true positive experience in clinic, and changed that, or I guess went into that feeling, that pain point, and said, I'm going to change this and create like this, you know, new model X plus Y. And then also this feeling of like, I didn't get mentorship, or I didn't have like a sense of career development during residency, and then creating these pathways that really address that pain point. It's really beautiful from a leadership and kind of change management perspective.
Yeah, we decided on those first six pathways, the two career pathways and four fellowship pathways. And from there, people just took it and ran. So most of the other pathways, actually all of the other pathways, were developed with residents and faculty or residents and fellows together. So we set kind of a base for like, what do they need to look like? And people have just gotten really creative with it. And healthcare administration is another one of our pathways. And that was actually started. We have a two-week elective called Create an Elective Elective.
Love that.
Where you actually take 2 weeks to create something new for the program. One of my former associate program directors, she's now my boss. She hates that I say that. It's honestly like the dream. She was a chief resident. She's an MD-MBA. She created a healthcare administration elective along with two other residents who also took the Create an Elective together, sort of back-to-back, and created a healthcare administration elective that's taught by the C-suites of all of the hospitals. So it's based in quality and safety and looking at things like compliance, a lot of systems-based practice that you did not get at the time she created it. It was, I think, 2018. So that was just an elective, and now that became a pathway, and now she's the associate CMO for ambulatory care. And so she was able to really take something she was passionate about, create something new, grow that creation, sustain that creation, and then along the way, while she was doing that, making the connections and networking and advancing herself, not strategically or maliciously, just by doing and showing how much she could do. And I'm so happy that she's my boss now.
Well, that sounds amazing that you were able to create a framework like that based on kind of the needs and wants of the people that you're working with, and then let others down the line take their energy and their passions to expand that further. Were there some biggest obstacles that you ran into in building these pathways, and how did you deal with those?
I mean, I think for the pathways, there weren't as many obstacles for the pathways, because residents kind of naturally anyway choose the electives that will help prepare them for whatever they're doing next. It was just really looking at them from through a critical lens and through a through the fellowship director lens, through the division chief lens, and saying, you know, what do these people need to be ahead when they start fellowship, and to be prepared when they're faculty, when they become faculty. And for us, it's become a training ground, but also a training ground, a preparation ground, and a retention ground, because people do get exposed to those mentors and spend so much time with them and really get to know them well, such that even if they go away for fellowship, we have many people that come back. So we've retained about 30% of our folks either in fellowship or coming back after fellowship as faculty and then participating.
So kind of going back to change management and leadership, what were kind of the overlapping themes that you had to kind of endure as a leader when you were going through the changes of the modified traditional to the X plus Y schedule and the changes of creating these career and fellowship pathways for the training program?
Yeah. I mean, I think from a resident standpoint, residents cycle through in 3 years, right? So what people have to go through, once they're gone, a new intern starting won't know that something's new. They'll just think it's the way. So I think in following the Cotter's steps, creating lots and lots of small wins for the residents, evolving things with the residents. I think many of those things were small wins, like the creating of the healthcare administration elective, but three residents worked together to create that in their last year of residency. And that's something that's been sustained. And I think involving people, I mean, even in quality improvement literature, when you look at it, when people are more passionate about something, they just do it better. They do it better. They're more interested. They're sustained. Like I said, people take it and run. We have a medical humanities elective now, which people created last year, piloted in May, and now it's run for two sessions this year. And the showcase will be in the next month, where people will showcase the work that they've done to reflect on the medicine. So I think the obstacles we faced in developing the pathways were not that many. The obstacles to the block schedule are probably bigger. And I think because it really is that reduction in resident workforce, number one, no one likes change. Number two, when you cut down the resident workforce in places, you have to substitute it either with faculty themselves, who have to now pick up work that residents were doing. So in some places, negotiations, like, okay, we're going to go from this being four residents to this being three residents. And we'll give you like a year to find it, to figure out another model, but we're probably not going to have residents in this space next year. So there were it was a lot of negotiating. And so I think the our initial sense of urgency was just really a big need for change. Residents were not happy. We had a couple of citations at the time. Now we have none, but we had a couple of citations at the time. The ACGME citations are a very easy external way to create urgency, a sense of urgency in an institution or in a department. And then the residents really wanting the change and really being unhappy at the time was the second, really the biggest sense of urgency. And then faculty who had been associate program directors and chief residents who had been wanting to do this and us saying, yeah, let's go.
Amazing. Well, thank you for talking us through that. Stephanie, now that you've made it through both of those transformations in your program, do you have anything that you wish you could tell your younger self as you were in the midst of these challenges? Anything that you've learned through the process that you can impart with us?
Yeah. Maybe one of the things that made me a little bit successful is that I just always kept my eyes on the prize. Like, this is where I want to go. This is where I want to go. How do I get there? How do I get there? Okay, I've changed this thing. Now what next? What next? What next? So I really kind of, I guess I've always had that mentality, like, okay, let's make it happen. Let's see what's next. Okay, now that we've got the block schedule, how can we leverage that for career development? Let's make pathways. The things that I would tell my younger self is to maybe be a little bit better at active listening and better in validating people's concerns and fears about change, because those fears were very real. People were really upset about losing resident services. And it was a big frame shift to think, okay, well, this is only a 12-bed unit. You don't need four people to do a Q3 call, a Q4 call. You maybe just need two people where somebody's doing days and somebody's doing nights. Let's right size not only the number of residents, but also the you know, what year are those residents? Are they interns? Are they second years? Are they third years? Are they fourth years in the case of Med Pete's folks? Or, you know, and looking at family medicine and looking at anesthesia, psychiatry, we have several different rotators, you know, who should be there? What do they need? And is everybody getting, you know, are we optimized? Is everybody optimized for getting what they need, getting good education, and also being happy and passionate about what they do? And I think allowing residents to be really involved in that evolution in creating electives, in creating these pathways. So like I said, only four out of these 18 pathways were created by administration. The rest have been created by residents fellows along with faculty, with the most recent one being created this year.
That's amazing. Well, it sounds like your program is lucky to have you, and it sounds like your leadership has taken them through some important changes. Do you have some main take-home points for our listeners?
Yeah, I think number one, you know, always keep your eye on what's important. I think that's the first thing. The things that are important for a program, whether it be a residency program, a nurse practitioner program, a pharmacy program, is what do the learners need to get with regards to education? And no one can really argue with you when you say this is not a good educational experience. You know, they can argue with you by saying, well, I don't want people to stay late. That's, you know, this is not a good educational experience. People have a hard time arguing with that. So keeping your eye on that prize always, being also patient-centric. That was one of the big questions that many of our detractors had. They said, you know, well who's going to take care of the patients? And I said, well, someone's going to take care of the patients. We're not going to abandon the patients. Let's figure this out together. So that, you know, making sure that the institution needs are met, and resident needs are met, and patient needs are met. And always keeping your eyes on making sure all those things are happening. And understanding the mission of your institutions, understanding the populations that you serve, and really trying to capitalize on your strengths and look at your areas for improvement objectively and making sure you improve them. And so, like, I think the very first thing I did when I took over the medicine residency program was I read through the internal medicine residency guidelines, like, line by line by line, and I said, what do we have? What don't we have? What are we missing? And what do we have too much of? And I made lots and lots of spreadsheets.
I love a good spreadsheet, Stephanie. Quick question. Was there anything that you wanted to plug? Because I know you talked about next steps, things that you're constantly kind of on the go thinking about for the future. But anything that you want to highlight for listeners before we wrap up?
No, I mean, I think our pathways are pretty unique. I think there are many, many residency programs that have, you know, one or two pathways or several different areas of concentration. I think that having not only fellowship pathways, but career pathways and allowing people to combine those, like having someone be in the cardiology pathway and the medical education pathway and having a goal of being a program director someday. I think it's a perfect opportunity for early career development. And that residency is, while a lot of it is about that clinical education, it's also about this life education, this career education, and not just being dropped into a place. I would like to think, I hope, Charlotte, that you were prepared, right? When you came out of our med ed pathway into assistant professorship, we do try to keep track of our folks and where they go and what they do. And I think so far, I think that 2020 was the first class of the pathways. And I'm just really proud of that. And I'm really proud of the residents, the fact that they're creative in thinking about ways to fill gaps, not just in their clinical knowledge, but in their happiness. Like the medical humanities elective was, you know, someone was interested in taking some of their residency experiences and really turning it into something creative. And so even within our medical humanities elective, we have, you know, well, I think most of the people who have chosen to write, we have people who are doing photography, people who are doing art, people who are doing performance. And I think, I mean, that's just fun. So residency, while it's all about the clinical education, you can have fun in residency. And I think that we do that here.
I can attest as a former resident that that does happen at your program. If talking to you makes me miss residency, which I think a lot of people would not say. So I'm so thankful that you were able to come on and chat with us and share your wisdom. Thank you again for your time. I have to call you Dr. Brown because this just seems strange not to call you Dr. Brown.
You have to call me by my first name now.
Okay, well, it's still not normal for me, but thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I'm sure our listeners are going to learn a lot of good information. I know I have.
Yeah, I hope this was helpful. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Well, that was a fantastic episode with Dr. Stephanie Brown. It was great to hear her thoughts of her process of leading her residency through two big transformations. And one thing that really stuck home to me is her focus on kind of keeping her eye on the prize and really thinking about sort of, even though there may be these challenges, even though there may be pushback, focusing on really what's best for our learners and moving towards that.
I also love that even with her eye being on that prize, she was always like, how can we be creative? Like, even from the very beginning where she kind of mentioned that her leadership approach and how she thinks about problems is being curious, being creative, kind of thinking really in very adaptive ways about it. And I love how she brought that approach to every kind of problem she faced.
Me too. And I also love the idea of the educational value and the RVU value for a resident going through residency training. As a recent resident graduate, I think I'm very lucky that I benefited from her leadership and had a lot of the EVU in my journey, the residency.
Absolutely. One more, actually. I love just how much she let the residents and fellows lead the way in creating new pathways. And I love the elective on electives.
You mean committee on committees that we're constantly being asked? So there's this amazing committee that you should never join called the Committee on Committees at where if maybe your institution has it, maybe not never, because never say never. Like, that could be a really important opportunity, but maybe avoiding it. Yeah, she's like, actually, I am that for Florida. She's like EDU versus RVU.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. And thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyplein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. And I've been Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CNE credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you for joining us today, and let us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment. I'm Charlotte Chicklin. Good night.